We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning and happy Thursday, March 6th. So the Supreme Court reminded America yesterday that they may be the branch of the federal government that may stand in the way of all of the great things to make America great again, not because of the U.S. Constitution, mind you, but just because, I don't know, they're being stubborn, they're being ridiculous, they want to remind us that they're still there. Well, yesterday, the Supreme Court justices in a 5-4 vote, and you can probably guess the lines there, with Amy Coney Barrett being the swing vote, with the left wing of the court, unfortunately, rejected Trump's request to freeze $2 billion in foreign aid, part of his effort to slash government spending and dismantle the deep state. So this coming from the New York Times, a bare majority of the court ruled against Mr. Trump in one of his signature projects. The president's many programs and plans, the order suggested, will face close scrutiny from a deeply divided court. So this was on emergency application. And so the court, in a unsigned, pretty brief order, basically just suggested that the district court will have to be more clear as to their rationale and should, quote unquote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill. So in addition to this, there are about 41 rulings so far that have paused Trump's initiatives, at least temporarily. So the Times is actually tracking all of these. You know, occasionally they're good for something, right? So the Times actually categorized them, all of these different challenges, into four categories. First is government overhaul. That's basically anything targeting DOGE and the help of Elon Musk for Trump trying to downsize the federal government. Immigration is the second category. Trump, of course, and his admin are trying to end birthright citizenship, all of the mass deportations, restrict asylum, withhold funds from sanctuary cities. There was a very contentious hearing in Congress yesterday where several of the mayors from the Democrat sanctuary cities, including my former home state of Colorado and Denver, the mayor was also there and came in and faced scrutiny from a lot of the representatives who were asking whether the sanctuary cities were going to comply with the federal government with respect to immigration. Really interesting hearing. The third category is reversing liberal policies. This includes things like environmental rules, all of the LGBTQIA+++ DEI initiatives, overturning all of those kinds of things. And the fourth category is press freedom. So things like blocking the Associated Press from access to the White House, some of those allegedly First Amendment concerns. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel of the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, let's start with this this USAID freeze emergency application. Personally, I was very disappointed in Amy Coney Barrett. Not really a shocker. I don't think that she is as conservative, certainly not as Justice Scalia, who she clerked for. But I think the excitement that conservatives had over her nomination is, I think we're seeing some disappointment there. So where did the majority go wrong here?
I think where the majority went wrong is which particular issue they chose to focus on. Now, what the majority looked at, and I think we can see that Justice Roberts and Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett are the kind of the swing votes on this court. Even though it is 6-3, it tends not to be with these two votes. But what they chose to focus on was a specific issue of whether contractors had been paid for work that was already completed. That was the issue before the district court in the USAID case, not a more general issue. Now, if the court had instead focused on the issue of whether one single U.S. district court judge could enact a sweeping order that stopped or required the entire U.S. government to do something, I think the outcome would have been different. But instead, justices chose to look at the more narrow issue of whether a contract that had been completed should be paid. And that's why the court ruled the way it did.
That's really interesting. And so what was the scope then of the emergency application and the arguments from the Trump administration and in terms of why the court chose to focus where it did?
Well, the case started when there were two foreign aid contractors that brought a lawsuit to challenge the cutoff of USAID funds to the State Department for work that they had already completed. So basically, they fulfilled a contract obligation and they wanted to be paid. Trump paused all payments from USAID pending review. And that's what the lawsuit was about, whether the Trump administration should be given time to review these payments or whether it was obligated to make them because the contract had been fulfilled. So what the district court judge did was he looked and said, wait, let's not freeze the funding. These people need to be paid, and we'll take it from there whether there's anything else left in the case. Now, after the judge did that, after the judge issued that initial order, then there were more issues because then Trump cut funding, didn't just pause the spending. So that opened up whole other issues that have yet to be decided. So the whole case has gotten more complicated, but it started pretty simply as groups that had done work and wanted to be paid. Trump's argument essentially is that if the government pays this money without investigating whether the work actually has been paid or whether it matches a priority that should be paid, we'll never see the money again. The taxpayer money is gone. And the judge here didn't buy that argument and basically said, no, the work was done. The people have to be paid.
And that seems to be a bizarre ruling for a majority. And is this just over politicized? Because, I mean, obviously in contract law, if there is a dispute as to whether there was performance on the contract and one party to the contract is saying I completed the work, they need to show that. And so just and for the Supreme Court, without really any fact finding, just saying, yeah, it should be paid. It seems like the irreparable harm here would be to the taxpayer and the U.S. government to say, yeah, you have to pay this without any sort of fact finding as to whether the contract obligation has actually been fulfilled.
And the alternative view, on the other hand, is that the government could always sue the recipients to get the money back if it's later determined that the work had not been performed. But I think the Supreme Court really punted on this. I think that they chose a very narrow path and did not want to issue something more sweeping, precisely because what was at issue, even though the issue has become a lot more complicated in the last 2 weeks, what this case was really about was specific funding to two organizations. And the court did not yet want to weigh in on the larger issue. I think they decided it was not the right case for that. Maybe it's this case when it makes it up on appeal again. Maybe it's another case. But I don't think this is the Supreme Court signaling that this is the way they will rule on all cases. I think they're just holding off until the right case comes along.
That's potentially encouraging. And so there was a dissent filed by the four justices that were in the minority, which in this instance included included Amy Coney Barrett. And so where was the minority in this case?
The minority was looking at the other issue. It was looking at jurisdiction. It was looking at whether that one judge could have the power to compel the government to pay pay billions of dollars on one order. And I think they were chafing at the bit to examine that issue, to examine the jurisdictional issue, to examine whether, essentially to get at the merits of whether Trump can issue these orders. But what the Supreme Court ended up saying was that we're not ready to look at that yet. We're looking at a very narrow issue on a contract payment. I think the minority, I think that Justice Alito was disappointed I think there was disappointment that the court didn't put an end to it now. But I think that we will see this issue come up again and we might not get the same outcome.
Interesting. And I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who is an attorney and the founder of the Lawfare Project. And there was a portion of this New York Times piece that is titled "Will Trump Listen?" and basically suggesting that if Trump goes ahead with some of these policies in the midst of the litigation, that this could lead to a constitutional crisis and, you know, some of these other kind of, you know, oh no, the world is ending from the New York Times. But I think in part it's at least a valid question as to the court's authority if they do overstep, and this entire role of judicial review as a broader question. You know, here I don't know that we're necessarily arguing that the court doesn't have subject matter jurisdiction, but at the same time, there are a lot of these things that we're seeing even with these 41 rulings where the court is likely overstepping because the executive has the purview to, for example, you know, fire within their own agencies, you know, some of these other things. So where are the constitutional battle lines being drawn in the broader conversation?
I think it's a little difficult perhaps to find the right words to express this, but I think it's really very early in this battle. If we recall some of the decisions that the Supreme Court came out with in the last 4 or 5 years, what they're basically showing is that we all think that the law says one thing. We've accepted, for example, that agencies have deference when it comes to interpreting laws when they make regulations. Until all of a sudden, decades later, the Supreme Court finally weighs in and says, no, you guys have been doing it wrong all along. Same thing with abortion rights. Same thing with a lot of opinions. So I think that right now, what the New York Times and all these articles are highlighting is our understanding of how things have been. And because they've been that way, the courts are likely to continue saying that they're okay. But the Supreme Court has not weighed in on these issues. And even though right now we're worried that the courts might be overstepping, if they do, it's the lower courts. It's not the U.S. Supreme Court. When these issues do get to the Supreme Court, we may have that complete change in understanding of how things work based on what decision comes out.
And that's a really important perspective, I think, to underscore that the left for a long time has been saying, you know, we all remember Senator Dianne Feinstein saying that Roe versus Wade is super precedent. There's no way it's going to be overturned. Well, it has been. And I think that you're absolutely right that the Supreme Court is viewing how we have always understood and applied the law and precedent. They're not being shy about revisiting some of that rationale and even overturning major doctrines like Chevron deference that you alluded to and some of these other things. And so this could be potentially in an interesting kind of collateral consequence of Trump's move to dismantle the administrative state, could potentially find a partner in that with the Supreme Court if they do revisit some of these decisions. But is it going to take longer for the Supreme Court to get to the merits of a lot of these things? Because this USAID case, of course, was only on emergency application. It's going to now go all the way back down to the district court, then probably find its way back up to the Supreme Court again, just because nobody's going to, you know, roll over and say, okay, fine, we lost. You know, I think that the parties will continue to challenge this. So what should we anticipate in a perfect world scenario for those of us who are conservative constitutionalists? What would be the best case scenario in terms of the Supreme Court saying, you know, yeah, this change and revisiting some of these doctrines, we're going to move forward in this manner?
Well, the first thing to remember is that the Supreme Court picks and chooses what cases to take. So they are ultimately looking for a fact pattern or in legal arguments that they really want to weigh in on. And clearly it was not this case at this time. Now, with all the litigation that's been filed against Trump and his executive orders, whether it's DOJ or the EOs, the Supreme Court will eventually see a case that it decides this is the one that we will use as a vessel for a larger ruling on what all of these cases are and how they should be interpreted and how they should be conducted. That will happen during Trump's term. It may not happen in this next 6 months. It may not even happen this calendar year. But I think the Supreme Court is looking. It shows that it's looking for cases on which it could make broader pronouncements to help guide future interpretation. And here, I think, again, we have to remember judges at the lower courts, they're responding in the same way that they've always responded. So the government has always done things this way. Now, all of a sudden, it's doing things differently. No, that can't be right. The Supreme Court is taking the longer view. They're looking at what all of these cases say, what all the judges are saying, and taking a wider view and saying, well, we have time to study this and decide how we want to rule and what case we want to rule on. So I think there's hope. There's definite hope that the Supreme Court will end up saying the right things on the right case. It's just not today.
Yeah, that is a much more hopeful view than, you know, a lot of the social media response yesterday lambasting Amy Coney Barrett for this decision. But Jared Folletti, last question before I let you go this morning. So within kind of these four categories or buckets that the New York Times has outlined, government overhaul, immigration, reversing liberal policies, and press freedom, what to you are the main issues that if you could decide and have the Supreme Court kind of reverse some of the bad precedent over the years, what would you like to see them select and either, you know, overturn precedent or create a pathway toward a better limited government?
I think immigration policy would have far-reaching consequences, because if the Supreme Court rules that a lot of the way that things have been done up until now, a lot of the lack of enforcement, the inability or the unwillingness of sanctuary cities to follow federal law, if the Supreme Court rules with clarity, that will carry over into a lot of other issues, like these woke policies, like speech issues. I think that's the thing the Supreme Court should focus on, because once it establishes that the federal law is supreme in many of these instances, that will help guide courts on a lot of other issues.
Well said. Well, Jared Folletti, I really appreciate your insight and your commentary today, and for dropping by for the second time this week. We always love your insight and analysis. So you should all follow Jared Folletti, founder of the Lawfare Project, on X. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning to continue talking about some of these legal issues and the grounds that Trump may or may not have in his America First agenda.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And we are talking about the landscape of the legal challenges to Trump's America First agenda, with the U.S. Supreme Court pausing the freeze on the USAID yesterday from the Supreme Court, and where they might head in another direction. The other issue is Trump is set to sign, potentially even today, an executive order abolishing the Education Department by dismantling bureaucratic bloat in the agency's, quote, momentous final mission. This is coming from the Daily Mail. And so the headline here is Donald Trump could make a drastic move. I love how, you know, it's like bells and whistles and alarms. Oh, no, it's drastic. To reshape American classrooms within the next 24 hours by shuttering the Department of Education. The president is expected to sign an executive order as soon as Thursday, which would bring about abolishing the federal agency, the Wall Street Journal report. So let's welcome in Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and the host of the Coleman Nation podcast. Really great commentary, only occasionally snarky. So Ron, good morning. And, you know, your thoughts, first of all, overall on where the legal boundaries are here and whether or not overall the Supreme Court may thwart Trump's agenda.
Good morning, Jenna. How are you?
I am great. I have my maple coffee. I'm really happy this morning.
Oh, that sounds perhaps sickeningly sweet, which is right up my alley.
Right? Yes, like me. I'm sickeningly sweet.
You ask, these are the questions that everyone is wondering about, and I think a lot of conservatives were quite disappointed yesterday with the Supreme Court's action. Among those conservatives are the four justices on the United States Supreme Court, one of whom is, of course, my fellow New Jerseyan, fellow Princetonian, Sam Alito, who has spent his entire, the better part of his adult life on the federal bench, and you would think has seen it all. And nonetheless, among the first things he says in the dissent from yesterday's decision is, I'm stunned. Wow. You think he'd seen it all, and he's stunned.
That's quite the statement.
There's a gigantic jurisprudential gap among the conservative justices. And really, it's a big mistake for people to say that, you see, this proves that Roberts and
Barrett?
Name escaping me. And
Barrett.
They're liberals. They're rhinos. No, these are conservatives. If you've ever heard them speak, if you've read the majority of their work, these are conservatives. But they have a very different judicial philosophy. And I think the question is whether it's a philosophy that is perhaps wildly out of sync with what's going on, not just politically and culturally, but what's going on in the courts. You've got courts asserting, you know, far exceeding their power, both constitutionally and jurisdictionally, which is exactly what happened in this case. And as Justice Alito points out, and in the face of that, you have Justices Roberts and, oh, what's your name? Brett Barrett. We're going to have some kind of therapy session about why I keep forgetting. Oh, I know why. I'll tell you offline.
I'll look forward to that text later. Okay.
Yeah. has nothing to do with her, I assure you. Their response is, well, we want to take a closer look at the district court's order is actually deficient. Send it back to the district court to be more clear about what it is we're reviewing. This is out of the appellate court handbook. It is really a very conservative small c, a very conservative approach to being a judge, judicial restraint. We're not going to step in until we know exactly what we're reviewing, and we're actually going to put it to the district court to make that decision.
And that makes a little more sense, you know, why Amy Coney Barrett was in that majority, because that's kind of her signature move. That's been her signature move, I think, for the entirety of the time she's on the bench, right?
That's a very good point. And it's the kind of thing that you definitely would expect Roberts to go along with as well. The problem, as Justice Alito observes, is, as we say in the extremely elite, thin-aired world of Supreme Court advocacy, dude.
that's the Latin term, by the way. Yeah.
this district judge has no business ruling on this, and regardless of how he refines his order, it's a ridiculous order. He has no constitutional power to make this order. Why? And meanwhile, $2 billion is going out the door, never to be seen again. Can you please pay attention to, and this is something that I am screaming in my head to appellate courts in particular, sometimes district courts as well. Will you please pay attention to what was actually going on planet Earth? This is $2 billion that a judge is unconstitutionally ordering the executive to spend. That should be all you need to know to put an end to it.
Yeah,
that's the debate.
That's such a great point. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, yesterday, my friend Bill Shipman, known on X and widely reviled among a lot of MAGA for not very good reasons, as Shipwreck Crew, who's a very experienced federal litigator and a very smart guy, said, you know, there was another case. I mean, there are about 4,000 cases pending now, right? I mean, judges have completely taken over as the only viable political branch for the moment. And the D.C. Circuit actually reversed the decision of the district court in the District of Columbia, which had ruled that the so-called ethics watchdog special counsel had to be retained by President Trump, even though he is the chief executive and all special counsels report to him. Everyone who works in the Justice Department works for the president. I didn't say they represent the president. I said he works for the president. Well, the D.C. Circuit stayed that order. So Schiff says, see, this vindicates Roberts and Barrett. This shows you that if you just take a deep breath, sometimes even the D.C. Circuit will do the right thing. Let's go through the front door.
The broken
clock,
perhaps.
That's a nice point.
Perhaps. Yeah.
Right. That's a nice point, except that $2 billion is going out the door. That's never coming back. It's never coming back. So this is a legitimate debate. It's not somebody has something on Roberts, nonsense like that. It's mm-hmm. This is who they are. These are the justices that we elected, that were appointed by the president. They're actually excellent choices. There are going to be moments like this where we're going to bang our heads. But I just want to remind people, and I think you and I have discussed this before, even though we'll never impress the other side, even though the other side will never acknowledge anything like, oh, the Supreme Court is actually legitimate, you know, then they'll scream and cry about Justice Thomas's wife and nonsense like that. At the end of the day, the equity that Barrett and Roberts are placing in the and retaining in the Supreme Court by not always making the move that we politically want them to make mm-hmm. pays off when an important decision comes down and they've demonstrated that they don't always make that cowardly move. Sometimes they do what actually has to be done. Obviously, overturning Roe versus Wade was one of those moments.
Right. And I'm speaking with Ron Coleman, who is an attorney and host of the Coleman Nation podcast. And I think a couple of points that you made were really good to underscore, which first, I mean, you and I, and I think the vast majority of everybody listening lives in the real world. So $2 billion is kind of a big deal. And the justices often, because they are so ingrained in all of these academic articulation, I mean, it's like being in law school and having all of these different hypotheticals. It's like somehow they're disconnected from that reality, and they are so concerned about the bigger overall judicial philosophy and, you know, whether all of these narrow issues come in and interplay and all of this, when you and I are sitting there going, it's $2 billion. Like, what are you doing? And so often we can expect that, unfortunately, from the court, where, of course, Trump is living in reality. But the broader question as well that I also want to ask you, Ron Coleman, so with all of that and that understanding of, you know, where the Supreme Court is situated, the hope perhaps we have that they'll make some decisions based on actual constitutional rationale, when they're saying things like, you know, Trump as the executive can't fire people that serve at the pleasure of the president, which is just nonsensical, where do you think we will end up with this dismantling the Department of Education, because this was a congressionally created, a legislatively created entity? And so the argument, of course, is that this can't just be a pen and an executive order to dismantle it. There's going to be pushback. So can Trump win at the end of the day when this isn't just an executive order that he undoes, anything dealing with a legislatively created agency?
It's a good question. I don't see, frankly, how he can. And I've been talking a lot in the last couple of days about the limits of rule by executive order. There have always been executive orders. They're part of they're the way the president governs, and they are the president doing his job. I was a little bit put off in the State of the Union address by the laundry list of executive orders that included things that can't possibly be the subject of executive orders. Sorry about that. One of them was mandatory death penalty for anyone who shoots a cop. How could the federal government possibly impose that, even if I don't even see how Congress could impose that?
Yeah, that's a state issue.
On what are state law crimes? It's so, you know, to a large extent, Obama moved the Overton window on how we look at these sorts of things politically. And it's a little bit of a problem. Your specific question on the Department of Education, let's put it this way. You don't have to be the towering legal intellects of Jenna Ellis and Ron Coleman to ask this question. That's a real no-brainer. Therefore, because I know the people who are making these policies, I was partners with White House counsel David Warrington until a year ago. My presumption is that there's a madness behind that there's a method behind the madness. I don't, you know, if you would have told me, and I had this discussion last night with Danny Ahn also, I don't understand, you know, if you told me that the Education Department, and this, Danny had thoroughly looked at the order, and it directs all kinds of things to happen that are within the purview of the executive, of the chief executive. You know, less of this and less of that, and here's how we're going to do this. That's fine. Congress sets up a department and, more controversially, allocates money to it. I don't see how the executive can abolish it other than by hamstringing it. And that's, you know, so therefore, what's the end game? What's the possible method behind the madness? I might want to say, if I really had the kind of confidence in the Supreme Court that is hard to have given the first part of our discussion, that what the president is trying to do here is to serve up a very slow pitch down the middle for the Supreme Court that will result in some enunciation, some non-incrementalist enunciation of just what the executive can and cannot do.
That would be helpful to clarify that.
Right. Now you have a guide. But that's a big ask.
Well, doesn't that kind of fall a little bit under advisory opinion potential? I mean, they did say, you know, they did have the presidential immunity, all of that. And so in just the last, you know, 30 seconds or so before we go to break, where is Congress in this? Because Congress, of course, could abolish it through legislation. And I thought we had the Republican trifecta. So why is this all on Trump?
Yes. So the other possibility that occurred to me was that this gives Trump the ability to turn to Mike Johnson and say, get it done.
Yeah.
This was what we ran on. Get it done.
And what I see, Ron Coleman, and I so appreciate your time. You can follow Ron Coleman on X. What I see him doing maybe with that pitch to the Supreme Court is also lining up the momentum for a landslide victory in the midterms, because we need a better conservative majority. We'll be right back with more. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight, fight, fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight, fight, fight for the babies.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are emphasizing the AFR documentary Culture Warrior. And if you have not yet streamed this movie, you can go to Culture Warrior Movie or culturewarrior.movie to watch Culture Warrior Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency. It's a great documentary that if you are a conservative Christian, you need to see. It tells the story of Don Wildman, but the film is much bigger than one man or ministry. It presents the untold story of Christian activism in America. So Culture Warrior also gets to the heart of the issues you care about and gives a fuller sense of why we continue to fight for decency today. So let's talk about, you know, fighting for America first and also where we've come from in terms of an issue that may not, you know, on its face be a specifically moral issue that you would, you know, readily assess that way. But all issues from an economic perspective or whether it's a cultural battle or whatever has either a correct view of preserving and protecting the rights of Americans that are God-given versus the government taking advantage of Americans. And one of those issues, of course, has been inflation. And there's a great piece from Jim Nels, who is a former Navy veteran and supply chain manager based out of Chicago. And the title in the Daily Wire is Overcoming the Biden Economic Hangover. The first major economic misstep of the Biden administration was the passage of the nearly $2 trillion American Rescue Plan. So, Jim, this is an important question because as Americans are suffering, I mean, AOC was going to go to the address to Congress waving empty egg cartons. And I'm sitting here thinking, well, that's a picture of the left, you know, really clearly of their, you know, stupidity, among other things. But really, the inflation and the present economy can and should be tied back to Biden's terrible decisions and those among his staff, not Donald Trump. So where do you see this issue and how do we and Trump kind of overcome the Bidenflation problem?
So first and foremost, Jenna, thanks for having me on. I mean, the Democrats looked incredibly stupid the other night as they sat there and waved their little signs. I was going to make a little sign for you today that just said, you know, I love Jenna, but I didn't have time to do that this morning.
But, you can post the meme later.
at the end of the day, these guys have to do something, right? And if you look at what Biden did, Biden pumped billions and trillions of dollars into the U.S. economy. He printed the money to do it. And so then we had more dollars chasing fewer goods, and that's what caused the inflation. If you look at, like, you know, like you talked about AOC with the empty egg cartons, okay, well, there's bird flu, and we've killed like 160 million chickens and turkeys and ducks. So that's why egg prices are high. But you know what? I was at Trader Joe's yesterday, and it was $3.99 for a dozen eggs, but you can only buy one dozen. It wasn't so bad, though, right? But here's what we need to do. We really need to think about how this economy needs to get back, and Donald Trump is doing all of the right things. He is reducing regulations. He is trying to make us once again energy independent. He is putting reciprocal tariffs back on other countries. And again, as a free market trader, I hate that, but I also understand, because if you're going to tariff us, we need to tariff you back. So, you know, I get that. I think that these are going to be gone very, very soon. I think he's going to force other countries to give up their tariffs on us, and then we'll give up our tariffs back on them. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's doing all the right things to get this economy going back to what it was pre-COVID.
Yeah, and it's going to take more than just 6 weeks. I mean, I love that the collaborative message from the Democrats is saying, well, what about the price of groceries? And, you know, we literally had, as Todd Stearns has said, the old man yelling with the cane, you know, from the congressional floor, which was just so embarrassing for the Democrats. But, you know, they're saying, oh, what is he doing to lower grocery prices and all this? Well, it's been a few weeks, guys. Like give him a little bit of runway here. But I think that that's going to be the message going into the midterms from the Democrats. If anything, the economy is the only thing potentially that they could focus on that actually impacts the American people if there's not some sort of recovery before, you know, November of next year. And so where can we get more quickly in terms of some economic rebound so that the economy is not damaging ultimately to Republicans in the midterms, as much as the Democrats may want it to be?
Well, I'm looking at the numbers right now, right? And, you know, we saw some increases in unemployment. We saw an uptick in the consumer price index. But the core CPI actually was right in line with what expectations were. What I'm really liking that I'm seeing right now is that we're starting to see more and more people invest in the United States. And that is a very, very important thing. We're seeing trillions and trillions of dollars being invested in the United States. That's going to create jobs. That's going to then help to create all the things that we need for this economy to get going again. And then we're also going to see things like, just think about it. We're going to see things like, excuse me, sorry.
You are okay.
We're going to see more and more people spend money. And the number one thing for the economy is confidence. And right now, if you look at the numbers that came out of President Trump's speech the other night, confidence is back. America is back. And that is what's going to drive this economy. I don't have any concerns about the economy moving forward. I think it's going to be red hot. I just hope that inflation doesn't pick up because of how hot the economy is going to be.
And so, you know, as I've been saying for a while, and I'm speaking with Jim Nels, who is an author and contributor to a wide variety of publications. In this instance, we're talking about his piece in The Daily Wire, which you can read, and it's titled Overcoming the Biden Economic Hangover. The first major economic misstep of the Biden administration was the passage of the nearly $2 trillion American Rescue Plan. So, you know, of course, as we've also been talking about, Jim, the Democrats, as idiotic as they presented themselves on Tuesday night, they're not just going to roll over and say, ah, well, you know, Trump got, even according to CNN, a 69% approval rating on his speech. So, you know, hey, I guess our plan isn't working and I guess our views aren't what people want. They're going to try to come back with a better strategy. And actually, a Fox News piece, interestingly enough, this morning said that the DNC has tapped a far left progressive to, quote unquote, revitalize the party. Yeah, this is beating a dead horse here, but or dead donkey, I guess, is actually the more apt thing. But to revitalize the party and try to infuse their messaging with more hope. That worked out well with Kamala Harris. But this just shows the Democrats aren't just, you know, kind of going away. And so what should the Trump administration be prepared for as we live in this kind of 24/7 election cycle?
Well, first, I mean, he needs to continue doing what he's doing, right? He needs to pass these executive orders. He needs to continue to push forward on the economy. I really want him to go harder on energy independence. I think that's going to really drive it. If you look at the price of oil right now, it's down about $66 a barrel, which is fantastic for the U.S. economy. But I also want him to continue to push hard to get more investment in the United States, because that's going to create jobs. That is going to help reduce the number of people who actually don't work. If you look at under the Biden administration, we had low unemployment, but the labor participation rate was terrible. And right now, I want to see more and more people get back into the labor market. I want to see them working again, and I want to stop paying for them to receive government subsidies. So President Trump's doing all the right things right now. I love the cabinet he's put together. I love the fact that they've been able to get these guys through the appropriations and through the Senate approval to advise and consent. But all we need now is just to keep pushing harder and to keep doing the things that we need to do. And again, Also, I mean, Jenna, look, I mean, he killed an ISIS terrorist the other day. He captured an ISIS terrorist the other day. And that got drowned out by all the other things that he was doing. So think about that. We captured an ISIS terrorist, and it made, like, the third-tier headline because of everything else that Donald Trump is doing. This administration is doing an amazing job, and I think that this the economy is going to come back. The U.S. is back. And like he said, America is back, and I fully agree with that.
And that's a great point, Jim Nels, that Trump is doing so much, it's actually impossible for the media to cover everything. And so typically the headlines that we see, especially from legacy media, are going to be, you know, the ones that are a little more, they're top line, they're things that maybe are more combative, or, you know, things like the Department of Education, for example, being dismantled, you know, some of these things. But some of the really important stuff that he's doing isn't getting as much attention. And we can't possibly cover 200 executive orders in an hour, even on radio. So it makes sense. But where in forecasting, you know, where Trump can go, especially with Doge and hopefully actually being able to reduce all of this ridiculous spending, and the tariff issue, all of this, will the savings of Doge, do you think, affect the economy, especially if Americans get some kind of refund, like Elon Musk is promising, potentially as much as $5,000? I mean, that is, yeah, that may be small for Nancy Pelosi in her fridge full of, or freezer full of ice cream, but, you know, for me and every regular American, that's kind of a big deal.
It is a big deal. And I mean, even Elon Musk will bend over to pick up a $5 bill, right? So I love what they're doing with Doge. And I think that the number one thing is not necessarily going to move the needle on the economy, but what it does is it exposes to the American people the waste, fraud, and abuse of the U.S. government. And it's going to get people to really think hard about who they want to vote for in the next cycle when we do the midterm elections. And then when we go to elect, hopefully, J.D. Vance as the 48th president of the United States. But that's what we really need to consider, and what we really need to be focused on is, even if this doesn't make America rich again, we need to focus on the fact that the government wastes so much money. We spend so much money on stupid things, and we funnel money to things that American people don't want to be done. If you look at what he's uncovered, just the amount of money that we spent on transgender people in parts of Africa, to like what President Trump said, that countries we've never heard of, we're giving them billions of dollars for transgender studies. Why are we doing that? Why can't we pay for homeless veterans instead of paying for transgender Africans at this point?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right that if the American people actually had a say and a vote on where our taxpayer dollars were being spent, I mean, this litany of line items that Trump mentioned in his speech on Tuesday, I mean, there were audible laughs even from members of Congress. And I know I was laughing at home going, yeah, this is utterly absurd. But it's frustrating to the American people. We wouldn't vote to spend our dollars willingly and voluntarily on these things. And that, to me, is theft. I mean, when the government is taking so that they can spend on priorities that we don't approve of, they are no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so this really needs to be assessed. And, you know, historically, the Supreme Court has said that the individual taxpayer doesn't have standing to challenge, you know, some of these things. But I think that that question needs to be revisited, and where Congress can actually spend money in the budget. And so just in the last minute we have, Jim Nels, I hope that a lot of this really is evidencing the waste, and at least voters will be more savvy, even looking at, you know, some of the Rhino Republicans. I mean, this isn't on partisan lines. This is about saying everybody, Republicans and Democrats, who are for big government and big spending, really should be primaried, and they need to get out of office to make way for the true economic conservatives.
I absolutely agree with you 100%. Jenna, want to primary everybody and make everyone re-earn their jobs. I think that would be a great thing for the American people, and we'll see who can stand and who won't stand. But at the end of the day, let's just continue to expose the government for what it is. and go after the waste and the fraud and the abuse.
Yeah, so well said, Jim Nelz. You can follow him at Real Jim Nelz on X. You can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. Have a great Thursday, and we'll come back tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.